Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in History, a channel of the New Books Network podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Julia Gossard. Chocolate. Nothing is more irresistible for a decadent treat or a rich drink to warm you on a cold winter's evening. In 18th century Venezuela, cacao became a life source for the colony. Neglected by the Spanish fleet system, Venezuelan colonists struggled to obtain European foods and goods. But they found a solution in trading the highly coveted luxury good, cacao, for the necessities of life with contrabandists from the Dutch, English, and French Caribbean. Establishing an intricate contraband network, Venezuelans normalized their subversions to imperial law. Today, we're pleased to welcome Jesse Cromwell to discuss his new book, The Smuggler's World, Illicit Trade in Atlantic Communities in 18th Century Venezuela, published in 2018 by the Omohundro Institute of Early American History and Culture and the University of North Carolina Press. This incredibly well-researched and beautifully written book explores how smuggling in the Spanish Atlantic became more than an economic transaction or imperial worry. Persistent local need elevated smuggling to a communal ethos, and Venezuelans defended their commercial autonomy through passive measures as well as violent protests when the Spanish state enacted the Bourbon reforms in the 18th century. Exchanges over smuggling between the Spanish Empire and its colonial subjects formed a key part of empire making and maintenance in the 18th century. Thank you so much for being with us today, Jesse.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me, Julia.
Of course. I'm really excited to discuss your book today, but before I get there, I want to give our listeners a bit of a formal introduction to you. Dr. Jesse Cromwell is Associate Professor of Colonial Latin American History at the University of Mississippi. His research focuses on imperial and Atlantic histories of Spanish colonialism in the 18th century Circum-Caribbean, with a special emphasis on how the Bourbon reforms affected the trans-imperial interactions, commerce, and mobility of a host of populations in the region. His work has been published in the Americas, History Compass, and the Latin American Research Review. He has received support from numerous organizations, including the Huntington Library, the John Carter Brown Library, the Spanish Ministry of Culture, and the Institute for Historical Studies. Jesse teaches courses on Latin American, Caribbean, and Atlantic history, as well as the history of piracy and commodities. So let's delve right into The Smuggler's World. Jesse, in the first 10 pages of The Smuggler World, I was really hankering for some old-fashioned hot chocolate, that rich, bitter type that you can find in Central and South America and parts of Europe. The use of chocolate as an entry point for your readers is a genius one that really got me hooked. But it also demonstrates how and why Venezuela was central to smuggling with the demand for this type of commodity. Given that, would you define your work as a type of commodity history?
Well, first off, let me just say, this is one of these funny things about a book, right? And I have to thank my editor, Nadine Zimmerly, because she suggested this idea of, here is this piece of your book that doesn't fit anywhere else, but I think it might fit here, right? And so it ended up becoming this prologue at the beginning of the book. It was sort of leftovers from a seminar paper that was roundly and rightly kind of pilloried the first time I presented it. So, these are the sorts of things that happen.
It's genius, though, the way that it's done there. It really gets you wanting to read the book.
Yeah, I hope it's not a bait and switch. But anyway, yeah, I mean, to answer your question, this is a type of a commodity history, right? Even though it's, I don't think it's salt or cod or, you know, oceans of wine or, you know, Molly Warsh's American Baroque, right? The commodity in this case isn't the central sort of interlocutor between people and places, although it, you know, I guess it could be at times, but that's not really the story I'm telling, right? But chocolate has some unique properties that inform this story. It grew especially well in coastal lowlands in Venezuela, and it was and still is Venezuelan cacao is still prized as sort of probably the best pure raw chocolate in the world. And you know, the documents that I would read in, you know, from the 18th century would have that that sense about them, right? Would talk over and over again about chocolates, Venezuelan chocolates' value and preference, right? It was a product that was storable and tradable and therefore smugglable, right? It's easier to get a hold full of chocolate together than a hold full of silver. It was a beverage and only a beverage at this time, right? Of taste and connoisseurship, particularly in the 18th century and in an Atlantic context, sort of like, you know, coffee or tea. It was imbibed by the wealthy and people of humble means as well. You see all of these stories in documents and in things other people have even written about, you know, how taken especially people in the Spanish Atlantic world were with chocolate, right? To the point where there are back and forth heated debates about whether chocolate violates the ecclesiastical fast and things like that, right? Right. Or what are its medicinal properties and this sort of stuff, right? So here is this beverage of real conviviality, right? That's mm-hmm. peaking at a time of salons in Europe, right? And I really thought when I was writing this introduction, well, how interesting would it be to kind of compare that sense of the beverage, right, to what I had been spending most of my research time looking over, which was sort of what the trading of this product looked like on the ground in Venezuela, right? And Venezuela at this time is this, you know, backwater that no one in the Spanish Empire had really been able to find a way to make a profit from. Mm-hmm. You know, and here it is, the mecca of this emerging raw material, right? So it's, you know, it pushes the colony very much into the Bourbon imperial eye, right? As sort of, you know, here is, you know, one of the means of imperial reform is here is a way we can take a colony that hasn't done a lot for us, you know, encourage its cash crop production, create a new stream of revenue, and sort of regularize and control the trade in that commodity. So, to that extent, you know, it's a commodity history.
Yeah, it's a commodity history. It's sort of the commodity of the Atlantic world, and it lets you examine so many other things around it. So it's not, like you said, a commodity, a history of salt or history of wine, but it allows you to go into these different areas of research.
Yeah, exactly.
And given that the smuggler's world sits at all of these different intersections of so many of the related historiographies, I mean, colonial Latin America, economic history, illicit trade, imperial policy, and that's just a few off the top of my head there, what do you see as the book's most central contribution then to Atlantic history?
Well, I think most importantly, I wanted to think of smuggling and informal economies as not somehow aberrational or niche to the story of the Atlantic world, but rather central to how people provisioned themselves, thought about community and moral structures, and contemplated and wrestled with empires. I think what I'm trying to do with the book as well is to sort of go beyond truisms about, oh, the Atlantic world was all connected, right? And to think more about who was connecting it and how. And then I don't know, the kind of motif running underneath in the book, because so much of this book is about smugglers and the people who trade with them, and from the perspective of prize courts, right? To reveal how early modern people thought about criminality, right? What were the acceptable limits of things we'd call smuggling or corruption or theft or violence, right? When is it sort of in aid of a community? When is it antithetical to what that community believes, right? It's sort of both within the context of the law, but also separate from it.
Right. And that makes a lot of sense. Given this kind of history of criminality and the ways in which people negotiated this, you mentioned early on in the book that casual observers to early modern history will hear the word smuggling and associate it heavily with pirates. I mean, after all, one of the kind of most ubiquitous images that somebody has of early modern Atlantic would be that of a pirate. But you're keen to explain the difference between smugglers and pirates. Do you think you could talk a little bit more about that, maybe tying that to the issue of criminality during this period?
This idea about I'm the pirate historian, right, has been the background noise of my work since graduate school, right?
Like a great and, hook, though, that you're the pirate historian.
And I hesitate with that, right? But I remember inviting one of my best friends when I was in Austin, Texas, right, to come to my dissertation defense. And he sat at my dissertation defense for, you know, a couple hours and then said, "Jesse, you almost didn't talk about pirates at all." I was really disappointed, right? You know, so I'm fascinated by pirates as much as anyone else, but you know, obviously this book is not strictly speaking a history of piracy, and I'm not strictly speaking a historian of piracy. There are people that do that work and do it really well. Pirates are a group and a story that nonetheless the general public can easily grasp onto and get behind. And you know, pirates as a group are what many, even scholars uninitiated to the history of the maritime Atlantic, think of when I say, oh, I'm doing sort of maritime Caribbean history, right, or maritime Atlantic mm-hmm. history. So it, you know, it has been a very convenient way in for me. But to get back to your question, it's interesting because pirates, despite all of this fame, commanded such a comparatively small share of the early modern global economy when compared to smugglers. Part of the confusion, I think, too, between the two groups and why I had to spend a few pages kind of breaking them down is this is a continuum, right? Both sort right. of occupationally and jurisdictionally, right? A maritime worker in, you know, his or in some cases her lifetime might be a pirate, a smuggler, a merchant, a sailor, a slaver, right? You know, these were often fluid designations, you know, in someone's life course, but also in the empire they found themselves in. Smugglers come from a broader, as far as the distinctions I would make, right? Smugglers come generally from a broader social class spectrum, right? They want to operate involving evasion or collusion more often than piracy, right? I mean, that's an element of piracy, but piracy, because it more explicitly involves theft, also more explicitly involves force or the threat of force,
Right. And you're very clear that these people in Venezuela themselves were not necessarily pirates. They were trying to work within the system.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, that isn't to say, right, I think the Spanish legal designations, for example, of Dutch merchants who were smuggling on the Spanish coast, right, would oftentimes, you know, sort of on one page say contrabandista, right, contrabandist, and on the next page, right, call them a pirata, right, a pirate, right, for bureaucrats, the distinction is not often made or is often forgotten, right, but yeah, I think to think of these people as pirates is a mistake, even though, you know, they are sometimes involved in violent actions in their own defense or in the process of trading, right? Even in the process of, you know, there's this term that gets bandied about, like comercio forzado, right? Forced trade, mm-hmm. right? And this idea that, you know, that Spanish subjects often make this point that, yeah, these foreigners came here and they made us buy their goods at gunpoint and they left some other things in return, right? And, you know, we can laugh about this and say, yeah, that we could probably read between the lines and note the falsity of these claims, right? But, you know, there are other examples of violence and people who are sort of caught in the crossfire of violence between smugglers and Coast Guard officials and things like that, but they do, you know, make the point that this is an unpredictable and illicit world where, you know, violence is often very much a part of it.
Definitely. I mean, I think that that's such a key part of this. Jesse, I think that this conversation about the legalities of smuggling versus piracy, you know, it really shows that smuggling allowed for great trans-imperial connections during the 17th and 18th centuries across the Atlantic. When you discovered all of these records of foreign smugglers, the Dutch, French, Portuguese, etc., what did it teach you about the interconnectedness of the Atlantic world?
That's a great question. I think what I was expecting to find were these documents that would talk about the way that people in different empires interacted and that it would be sort of full of intrigue and secrecy and diplomacy and all of, you know, sort of statecraft. But I think what I was struck by and what really surprised me was that at least in my little corner of the Atlantic world here, interconnectedness was a lot more normal and humble, if I could use that word, than I'd have guessed. The types of ships that smugglers were using were oftentimes, you know, down to the level of, you know, they would call them like canoas, like canoes, right? Going 60 miles between Dutch Curacao and Venezuela. The traders were much more humble than I would have guessed. That, you know, it really kind of reinforces something that I remember reading in Ernesto Bossi's excellent book about the Atlantic world, or Atlantic world commerce was much more of a peddler's commerce than a wholesaler's commerce, right? I'm sort of paraphrasing him here, but that sense of these are not diamonds and rupees and silver by and large that's being exchanged. We're talking about incredibly humble, cheap goods, you know, coarse cloth and you know, simple foodstuffs and liquor and things of that nature, right? And so, you know, I was struck by that. I was struck by how much of the map many subjects had in their head, right? As far as that people that I thought were sort of coastal dwellers could think about what was going on in Curaçao and Barbados and Martinique and you know, islands where they might not even set foot. And how much more they sometimes knew about commercial conditions than the state did.
I think that that's a part that is particularly interesting to me. So for our listeners, Jesse and I went to the same doctoral program at the University of Texas. And I think that we had several advisors, you know, Jorge Canizares Esquera, Ann Twynham, Julie Hardwick, that all really made us look very carefully at the normal, everyday people of these negotiations, and that they were incredibly savvy, that they knew about the interconnectedness of the world in a way that historians hadn't recognized previously. And I think you do that really well in your book here.
Thank you. You know, I try, but, you know, I think that aspect, or I had a conversation with a colleague in my department at some point, and he said, oh, you know, who would you want to be from your research if you could be someone, right? And I started breaking down for him this guy who was essentially a supercargo whose job was to go, you know, from island to island, port to port, and kind of gauge what people wanted and needed in terms of goods, and to kind of keep that math in his head for a larger merchant. And you know, and he said, oh, that sounds really boring. That just sounds like a bean counter. But it's a bean counter who's also judging, you know, political conditions. It's a bean counter who understands sort of the what's scarce for people and why. It's a bean counter that knows something about the both the economics and the social structure of the plantation system. You know, one of the best parts about working on smuggling is how much it connects to all of these sort of larger themes in the Atlantic.
Absolutely. And I think that that's very apparent. I find that funny. I'd like to be a bean counter. Well, that would probably have been a very interesting position to have had there. We couldn't all be kings and queens and, you know, big time pirates and everything. So I thinking generally about this idea of smuggling, your chapter Contrabandists or Cargo is one of the most innovative of the book. And I think shows your breadth of being able to cover Atlantic history, economic history, as well as the history of slavery. And it really highlights the ways in which Afro-Caribbean sailors and slaves navigated or were part of the contraband trade. And I'm just wondering if you could discuss some of these experiences for our listeners. I think this is definitely a chapter many people will be interested in reading.
This was the first chapter I wrote when I was writing the dissertation. And it sort of burst out of me because it was the first place where I really felt like I had something to say, which is, and that's a little strange because I don't necessarily consider myself a historian of slavery or the slave trade. But I said to myself, well, you know, there've been a couple of articles and things about people of color or enslaved people who work on ships or who trade, or, you know, there's even Linda Rupert's work that's excellent about Afro-Caribbean contrabandists. But I started thinking the contradiction of people who could be cargo and contrabandists, as the chapter was titled, how mind-boggling that is to us, but how it fits so much with the logic of early modern commerce. You know, that moments of smuggling, but also the sort of seizure of goods or the enforcement of early modern commercial law opened places where these distinctions kind of merge together. So what I found out was smuggling could be a path into slavery for many, and others have worked on this pretty extensively. I mean, Greg O'Malley's book is very much there are several chapters that are about illicit slave trading between ports in the Caribbean. It could be a task, right? Smuggling could be a task just like any other for enslaved people. It could be an occupation or a path to autonomy for both the enslaved and for free people of color. And it could be a means of escape for runaways. And, you know, that chapter opens with an enslaved person or a formerly enslaved person named Juan Pedro Antonio in 1763, who is captured on a French ship from Martinique that's illicitly trading in Venezuela, and he is forced to do time on sort of a work gang, and after he finishes that, he's allowed to live as a free man in Venezuela. And his master, a guy by the name of, in the documents anyway, by the name of Juan Antonio Marion, petitions from Martinique to Caracas to bring this guy back. He says, "That's my slave." And you know, this guy used this voyage as a way to run away. And there's this whole back and forth in the documents about you know, whether he's free or enslaved, and he claims that he's free. And you know, the judge eventually gives him the option of finding a buyer for himself, right? Essentially selling himself back into slavery so that he can stay in Venezuela and not be subject to this owner, this slave owner that he is, you know, run away from. You know, and I don't have time to go into all the ins and outs, right? But these are the sorts of gray areas that I found fascinating, right? Or you know, slaves that are enslaved people that are entrusted with taking the cacao and goods of 5 or 10 slaveholders from a plantation region downriver to market, making trades and coming back with you know, finished products. Some of this is slaveholders wanting to evade, you know, potential capture, potential punishment themselves, but there's a level of sort of trust there. And I think smuggling allows us to examine a whole range of occupational identities and also to examine sort of jurisdictional identities. What happens to foreign Afro-Caribbean contrabandists, both free and enslaved, when they enter into a different legal system and are caught, and that whole knowledge of whether they're free or enslaved is totally thrown up in the air, right? And who can vouch for them, and who would say this person is a free man, and what sort of justifications hold sway?
Yeah, and what you're doing there is you're wading through all of this different gray area that people constantly had to navigate for themselves to know what side of the law, what side of society they're sitting on there. And that's one of the cool things about history, is that it does allow us to not just look at the world through, you know, very stark terms, but to understand the nuance and the complications of the ways in which people identified and had to exist within the world. And your book really demonstrates that for 18th century Venezuela. Yes, it's a colony of the crown, but there were many practices that the crown would not have necessarily agreed with. Yes, it was a place where the slaves were, but slavery meant something very different, and there was different negotiations within that. So I think that that's a really cool aspect of your book there. I think one of the things that you were talking about extensively here is sources. and the ways in which these sources provided a lot of information to you. And you really describe your methodology very nicely in this book. And I would encourage the graduate students or the first-time authors who are listening to this to go read the methodology section. It was really enlightening for me to see somebody be so forthright about their methodology. Since the practice you're looking at was more or less supposed to be secret, you had challenges with your sources. I love the section in chapter one on page 25 where you say, quote, "The archival sources documenting illicit commerce, when properly utilized, allow for multi-perspective analysis uncommon in colonial history." I was wondering if you could help us understand how your methodology and those sources are unusual in this regard and how you navigated that.
The records I primarily used, which sort of the bedrock source of this book, is a number of prize court records. Prize courts are people that adjudicate seized shipping and determine whether or not it's contraband and whether or not the goods should be repossessed and auctioned, and whether or not contrabandists or merchants should be punished and how. These prize court records, as you're pointing out, only show who got caught. And what I noticed, and there are a few books that are notable exceptions, but what I noticed from the majority of the historiography in Latin American history, Caribbean history, Atlantic history, was that except for a handful of studies, the historiography either omitted smuggling or sort of talked about it obliquely, but said, oh, we can't really know anything about that. Or because we can only know who got caught, tried to do this quantification exercise, right? Well, if this many people got caught and we figure it's this much of the shipping, then, you know, smuggling might have been this percentage of the economy. And that's valuable too. And I'm not trying to knock, you know, quants everywhere, right? But I wanted to study it as an occupational practice. And then later I saw this as a crossroads between so many issues of empire, slavery, material culture, rebellion, moral economy, etc. So smuggling, as I dug in, seemed to be everywhere in the records, but also distorted. As I said, only those who got caught. That the records tended to be from a very statist perspective. Smugglers wanted to be anonymous. They never would have sort of written a tract about, or almost none of them did write a tract about, oh, this is why I'm a smuggler and how I smuggle and all these sorts of things. And oftentimes the ones who get caught don't see
the ego documents
exactly,
of smugglers,
right?
They're not necessarily
there. And
oftentimes
the smugglers who got caught didn't see themselves as criminals or smugglers at all. So there were lots of misperceptions on the part of the state as far as, you know, what these people were doing, or, you know, officials that quite clearly were trying to cover their own tracks because they were complicit in illicit trade. And from the perspective of contrabandists, there's lots of accumulated informal knowledge about how to lie, how to formulaically confess, how to keep contacts, or the extent to which someone was a habitual illicit trader, how to keep those things hidden. So I found I had to do a lot of reading between the lines, and it just took a certain amount of reading the documents. And this is why I would, you know, counsel any graduate student to not just take those at an archive, but also spend a little bit of time reading. You know, it just took a certain amount of reading documents to mm-hmm. start understanding their internal logic. I found the archival material to be split between imperial and colonial concerns, right? So what made its way to Spain was stuff that would concern the crown or the council of the Indies or these really important bodies about the economics of the trade, about, you know, potential issues of unrest amongst populace, you know, some very important officials who get prosecuted for contraband trade, these sorts of things, or their complicity within it. But what stayed in the colonial archive, what stayed in the Archivo General de la Nación in Caracas, Venezuela, were, you know, really everyday documents down to people who were smuggling or buying, you know, tiny quantities of smuggled goods, right? So you had, I had both these kind of, this is what matters to the state, right, and this is kind of what's happening, you know, way down on the ground. So, you know, I ended up with a bunch of documents that are wonderful in the sense that they allow, and the reason I have that statement that you quoted in the book is, it's not just someone is caught and judged and prosecuted. They allow the traders to talk, right? And oftentimes these folks will tell you about itineraries and what they were doing and who they were interacting with and the places that they traded and what they traded and right, all this sorts of stuff. So you can build this really rich picture of 18th century commercial life, right? But it's filtered through the state. And I would get these questions at conferences or symposiums or things saying, you know, aren't you just seeing these people like the state did? Why do you even use the word smuggler? They wouldn't have thought of themselves as smugglers. And they're right to an extent, right? But I have these documents because the state thought of them that way. I can study these people because the state thought of them that way. And that tension between sort of an Atlantic fluidity where, you know, people could smuggle and then trade legally and, you know, hop between empires and hop between islands, and that tension between that Atlantic fluidity and imperial and jurisdictional rigidity, right? Where empires did matter and people were caught and people were judged smugglers, and the human consequences of that could be destructive, right? That tension is at the heart of my methodology.
Jesse, are you there? Did we lose you? Okay. It sounded like it just cut off really abruptly, but I think we'll be able to fix that. Okay. We're going to cut back in here. I think that methodology that you're talking about is sort of the perennial issue when you want to tell a bottom-up history. You are limited in many ways by the sources available to you. And what you've done is you've been able to take the imperial or the state documents and find voices and experiences within them that I think is a really creative way that we've had to get at this bottom-up history for the past generation of doing this, and something that I'm sure other people are struggling with how to do in many ways.
Yeah, certainly. And I think anyone, I mean, historians always have their questions that go unanswered when they're done with their studies, but especially with these documents of illicit practice, I have so many questions that I still don't have an answer to, or that I took a stab at, but couldn't quite answer, as far as sort of what makes everyday people want to buy small amounts of illicit goods despite the risks. And, you know, I sort of talk about some cultural understandings of that, and you know, that European goods do mean a lot to identity and things like that, right? But nobody really asked these people, why do you want to own, you know, this or that cloth from Holland, right? And you know, also, I just started to sort of get a sense of a few what I call smuggling rings or kind of commercial networks. But, oh boy, there's so much that I wanted to know about who knew who and how deep some of these contacts go, and right. I mean, you it's like you would really like to see the flow chart on some of these really, really intricate smuggling. Yeah,
and that's kind of the issue we all have to deal with, is the unanswered questions that we will never have answered because the documents in our evidence just doesn't lead you to answer those things. And precisely. I think that that's one of the most interesting and frustrating parts of what we do. Given
work for future people.
Yes, exactly.
Right?
Yeah, leave all of your decision making processes somewhere so that future generations will know. Given sort of this discussion of methodology, I think that this section lends itself, as I said, very well to graduate students as well as to first time authors. So I wondered what your advice is to graduate students in Atlantic history at this moment in time. What are some kind of key takeaways that you'd like to tell them?
That you'll wear multiple hats, right? I mean, I think of myself as a Latin Americanist, a Caribbeanist, and an Atlanticist. But though you wear multiple hats, and you should keep sort of your membership in all of these, or your intellectual membership in all of these current, emphasize
which is important for the job market. But
well, I was about to get that where I was going. Emphasize the one that can get you the most job interviews. Right, for me, it really was that regionality still matters, despite me wondering or thinking that maybe it didn't. Right, I mean, 90% of when I was on the market, 90% of the jobs were in Latin American history. Right, there weren't that many Atlanticist jobs. Right, but beyond the kind of brass tacks, practical matters, right? I think sort of methodologically, I think Atlanticists or budding Atlanticists should not rush to shove everything into an Atlantic or transnational or global framework, right? Some things don't belong, right? And saying the word too much causes it to lose its meaning, whatever that means. Instead, I would encourage Atlanticists to try and map out how and why their historical subjects are connected across empires, cultures, oceans, etc. I would say graduate students that are working in Atlantic history should pick a manageable topic that develops out of the archives and print material that they can get at, right? Rather than the other way around, right? To think about something that is gigantic and requires you to be on three continents and all that stuff is wonderful, but that may be a second project.
Right.
That may be
your magnum opus in a way.
Exactly. Right. More to the point, if you have this wonderful idea for a project and then don't find what you're looking for, right now you start to wonder, well, was it in this other place or that other, you know, that other continent or things like that? And, you know, resources are finite. I also, especially for Atlanticists, reading widely, I think is really important. I mean, I got picked up by a press that traditionally focuses on early America, right? And by early America, I'm talking about, you know, 13 colonies and they're, the Omohundro is certainly branching out and very much thinking about vast early America now. But, you know, that press is still not on the radar for many of my Latin Americanist colleagues. And I think Atlanticists can develop their own opportunities by reading widely and thinking that way. And then finally, you know, Atlanticists should smile in the knowledge that they're uniquely positioned to avoid, investment in sort of dogmatic, nationalistic, historical narratives, right? I mean, that's one of the best things about investigating history the way that we do, is that, we're not necessarily kind of straitjacketed into some of these long historiographical debates.
Yeah, you can really complicate that narrative and oftentimes disregard ones that don't necessarily fit with what you're seeing and change perceptions.
Precisely.
Thinking about this reading widely and thinking of yourself as both a Latin Americanist as well as Atlanticist, how did that get you interested into 18th century Venezuela as a research topic?
I was interested in maritime and Caribbean history well before graduate school. I grew up in North Florida and, you know, spent my teenage years playing around at the Castillo de San Marcos and St. Augustine. And, you know, so that interest went way back. When I began graduate school and was trying to kind of settle on topics, I read a book by Lance Gran about smuggling in New Granada. And I, at the same time, I read a book by Pablo Perez Mayana on Spanish sailors in the Carrera de Indias, in the silver fleets. And those books were really impactful for me for thinking about sort of how do common people interact in really large and sometimes fraught Atlantic systems. I took this idea about maybe writing a work on contraband trade and questions of illicit economies to my advisor, Ann Twynham. And, you know, she said, try Venezuela. And I said, oh, well, why or what, or, you know, why Venezuela? And she said, you know, everything was upside down there and the province was powerful and by comparison to the empire, and the records are good and they're all really well cataloged. And, you know, so it's one of these things where, you know, she didn't force upon me a topic, but she had, you know, as many of us encounter, she had an encyclopedic archival knowledge that allowed her to keep me from reinventing a wheel and push me towards this colony. And I didn't know that I was going to necessarily write about it, but I did some searching of old archival guides and bibliographies and really confirmed that she was right, that this is that Venezuela had and has an incredibly rich and well-cataloged archive, right? The Archivo General de la Nación is, as far as, you know, in country, but also that Venezuelans had in the 60s and 70s used oil money to send some of their best historians to Spain to catalog everything in Spain that pertained to Venezuela. So, you know, by comparison to people who study, I don't know, and I don't want to speak too authoritatively, but that study, I don't know, Argentina or Ecuador or something, right? I mean, there are, you know, 20 volume indexes on various parts of Venezuela and the documents pertaining to them that are in, you know, the Archivo General de Indias, the largest sort of document repository in Spain about colonial Latin America. So it was a real head start and a real way to focus work. And then getting into it, I started to find this 18th century society, colonial society, to be intrinsically fascinating. In that, you know, it kind of has these perfect conditions for illicit commerce, right? And by that, I don't mean to say that, you know, Venezuelans in the 18th century were somehow more criminal than anyone else or something like that. That's not the point, right? But to the political conditions as far as, you know, the rising of a cash crop, reform efforts coming from the Bourbon crown, and the development of this, I detail it a lot in my book, but the development of this Caracas company, which is this sort of private monopoly company that has kind of paramilitary arm for enforcement that is tasked with, you know, controlling and regulating the Venezuelan cacao trade. You know, I started thinking, wow, there are some real pieces here that are at play and in tension with one another that could make for a really, really interesting study. Yeah.
So I think one of your other pieces of advice to graduate students is definitely to follow advice of your advisor as well, given Ann Twynham's excellent suggestions there. All right. Well, thank you, Jesse, so much. It has been a pleasure to get to talk about your research, about the smuggler's world, and learn more about your perspective into the 18th century Atlantic world. Thank you for so much for joining us today. A special thank you also goes out to the Omohundro Institute of Early American History and Culture, as well as the University of North Carolina Press for a review copy of The Smuggler's World. Head over to UNC's website to purchase a copy of this book. And finally, thank you to our listeners for joining us today at New Books in History, a channel of New Books Network. I'm Dr. Julia Gossard, wishing you happy reading.